Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
After I left, seemed to have taken its toll.
You can remove the mask there. So you can remove the mask if you like.
You sure?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, I don't want to kill anyone, but.
We are keeping our distance, so
okay.
No problem.
So, this discussion is going to be on connections between Star Trek and The Tempest. I'm going to go a couple of different places with this. I'll do my best to sort of outline what I'm doing as I go. Who am I? Why should you care? My name is Dr. Edmund Schlussel. I am a PhD in theoretical physics, but by day I am a math teacher. And I am also a writer. I'm going to plug my books heavily. I have some things available for you to buy later. And the origin of this talk is a project that I started early on in lockdown when I was stuck at home and had little to do and little creative outlet. I decided, well, it's been a while since I watched Star Trek, I'm going to watch it all again from the beginning, every single episode in the franchise, every movie. And as a writing exercise, I was going to break every episode down from a critical analytic perspective. And the initial seed of that was the release of the series Picard. But as I started going through, I began noticing some other patterns that I thought were noteworthy. Specifically, I noticed that in the original series, and also in other series in the Star Trek universe, episodes often seem to follow a template established in the play The Tempest by William Shakespeare. Now, I'll summarize what happens in The Tempest, just because it may have been a while since you last read or saw that. On an island in the Mediterranean lives the wizard Prospero with three companions, his daughter, the naive Miranda, and two mystical servants, Ariel and Caliban. Ariel is an ethereal servant, something that we would call a spirit or ghost kind of thing. Whereas Caliban, the son of the Witch of Sycorax, who had previously run this island that Prospero was on, is described and depicted as monstrous, not unintelligent, but bestial in habits and behaviors. Anyway, Prospero is on the island because he used to be the Duke of Milan, but he was deposed by his brother. And one day, he sees a ship with his brother on it passing by, and so he causes that ship to harmlessly, no one dies in this play, wreck on the island, bringing ashore his brother and several other people. At this point, the plot splits into three parts. We have a group of nobles. Including the King of Naples and some advisors and Prospero's traitorous brother in one group. And this group is tormented and vexed by Prospero's magic and Ariel's powers. We have two of the king's servants, the jester and the butler, meet Caliban, and together they plot to overthrow Prospero as ruler of the island. And the king's daughter Ferdinand romances Miranda, king's son, not the king's daughter. Now, there isn't much of a plot in this play in general. It's a Shakespeare comedy, which is not exactly plot heavy. But once all of these three arcs have been gone through, everyone reunites and basically everything resolves happily. Prospero gets his dukedom back, the traitorous nobles give up their plots, Caliban admits the error of his ways, Ariel is freed from captivity, and Miranda and Ferdinand go off to get married, and Prospero gives up magic and returns triumphantly as Duke of Milan. So now let's look at a couple of Star Trek episodes in detail. This is a permanent marker. Very early on in the series, The Man Trap. Dr. Crater is a scientist who lives almost alone on an alien planet with his wife, Nancy. But Nancy is also secretly a monstrous salt vampire, the last survivor of the civilization that lived on the planet. The salt vampire kills a couple of red shirts. In the guise of Nancy, though, has a romantic connection, is an ex-girlfriend of Dr. McCoy, and also has the power to appear in different forms. And as such, can deceive the crew, usually by appearing as some sort of desirable partner. Anyway, bad things happen. The salt vampire dies. Next one, Requiem for Methuselah. I'm not going to go through every single one in detail, but I'll just show some examples. What happens in Requiem for Methuselah? Well, Flint is an inventor and artist who lives alone on an alien planet with high technology. He has a ward Raina, who romances Captain Kirk. He also has a robotic servant and uses his powers to torment the crew in various ways, like shrinking them because he wants to be left alone. It's actually one of Kirk's strongest emotional connections in the entire original series. In What Are Little Girls Made Of? Dr. Corby is a scientist who lives almost alone on an alien planet. Corby is, in fact, the former fiancé of Nurse Chapel, and he has some android servants. Andrea and Rook. Rook is a 7-foot tall monstrous servant played by Ted Cassidy, who kills a couple of red shirts. You can start to see where I'm going with this now. There are certain beats that the episodes keep hitting. Some sort of scientist living as a hermit with usually a female companion, with some kind of technological or monstrance servants in his under his control. A couple of red shirts die. There are various challenges. There's a romance between two of the characters. The ending is not always happy. It's not a perfect match, but I think the key thing driving this is that The Tempest is a 3-hour play. It's got 3 plot lines going on in parallel. Typical TV episode is 45 to 55 minutes long. There isn't time for all 3 plot lines. And so going through all of these again and again, a sub-pattern is that they all follow some sort of economy when you try to match them against the original script of The Tempest. Usually there's a combination of the Ariel and Caliban figures into a single figure, or some other kind of combination. In fact, in Metamorphosis, where Zephram Cochrane is a scientist living alone on an asteroid, in this case, not a planet, and he has partial control over a gaseous entity called the Companion. There are only actually 6 roles in this episode. There's only 6 actors in this entire episode. There's an immense economy achieved because the Companion is also the love interest. And the sole guest starring woman, Nancy Hedford, literally merges with the Companion to become part of that plot. So Metamorphosis brings the entire thing down to as few moving parts as possible. Now, I could go over this episode by episode by episode, but you would see the same thing again and again and again. In fact, I would argue that of the original 79 Star Trek episodes, 13 of them, that's 1 in 6, follow essentially this framework, including the series' original pilot, The Cage. You have Captain Pike in a romance, quasi-romance plot with Vina that he's forced into with various tribulations, the same as Ferdinand goes through romancing Miranda. You have Number One on the ship trying to use the ship's technology to overcome the mind tricks of the Talosians who run the planet. And so this is something that is in Star Trek's DNA from the very, very beginning. And what the episodes I've cited here, the sampling, are from every season of the original series. You don't see quite this extent of this template in the further Star Trek series, in Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager from that era. But I can give you a couple of examples. The Arsenal of Freedom in season one of TNG, the Schizoid Man in season two, we'll always have Paris in season one. Brothers in season three, the episode Shadow Play in Deep Space Nine. But the basic pattern does seem to go away as the next generation goes on. So what's going on there? Well, I want to make a quick detour. Who's seen Forbidden Planet? Hands? A couple of you. Not all of you. Well, I'll summarize, but you'll very quickly see what's going on. Forbidden Planet, 1956 film starring Walter Pidgeon and Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen in a pre-comedy role, by the way. An Earth spaceship lands on planet Altair 4 and finds Dr. Morbius living almost alone with his daughter, Altera. Morbius also has two servants, the robotic Robbie the Robot, and the technology of the planet's former civilization, which is now extinct. What do you think is going to happen? One of the crew seduces Altera. A lot of the crew are tormented by the mind powers of the alien technology. In fact, it's Dr. Morbius' subconscious in the film. One of the crew tries to convince Robbie the Robot to defect and fight the alien technology, but the robot is unable to turn against its master. Forbidden Planet is almost a perfect match for the Tempest. Beat for beat, character for character, with Robbie the Robot being the Caliban figure and the alien technology being the Ariel figure. It is the Tempest in the same way that the Lion King is Hamlet. Why am I talking about something that happened 10 years before Star Trek? Well, as we move away from season three in Star Trek and we get into what we can broadly call the Berman era of Star Trek, we see a change in how the show is written. During the early seasons of Next Generation, a lot of the original writers from the original series were brought on board. Gene Roddenberry was still involved in creative decisions, but Roddenberry was very ill and dies during, if I remember correctly, season three. Meanwhile, the new writers who are coming on board, and these are people like Ronald D. Moore, are much more in tune with mythic ideas in general, but also are second generation fans, people who already have Star Trek in their heads when they go to work on the Next Generation. And so, as we go into seasons 4, 5 of Next Generation, the beginning of Deep Space Nine, there's a shift to a much more self-aware Star Trek. Now, some direct evidence of this in general, very general, is how we have the episode Far Beyond the Stars in Deep Space Nine, which is entirely a dialogue about the state of science fiction in the 1950s in the United States. We have the repeated appearance of Captain Proton on Star Trek Voyager, another homage to adventure serials. And that is something else that is deep in the show's DNA. But right around the time this transition happens, in the episode The Vengeance Factor, which is not too memorable an episode in and of itself, but right at the beginning of The Vengeance Factor, there is a backdrop that appears. They're on a mining colony. You wouldn't notice this backdrop as anything other than a backdrop unless you know to look for it. But the production staff of The Next Generation made a point of going out of their way, and it actually lobbied for the use of, an original backdrop from Forbidden Planet to be used in that episode. They actually found the prop from 35 years, something like that, previously, and got it into an episode. Now that's indirect, that's via this medium of Forbidden Planet, which was very important still in its time. But I also want to point out, in season 7 of The Next Generation, the episode Emergence. Again, Emergence is not in and of itself a particularly memorable episode. It's not one of the ones that's remembered as one of the classics. But it takes place right at the end of Next Generation's run. It's 723, I think. And in these last episodes of Next Generation, they're taking the direction of finishing off character arcs and loose ends that have built up across the series. You know, Wesley shows up again in order to go off and journey with the Traveler. Damon Bok shows up again for no particular reason from season 1. He comes back. But in Emergence is the goodbye to the Enterprise itself. And in that episode, which is a very Jungian episode, you have the Enterprise, the ship, given a psyche with multiple different facets that become real through the medium of the holodeck. And how does that episode begin? Well, that episode begins on the holodeck with Data working with Captain Picard, and Data, as part of his exploration of humanity, performs as Prospero. And then, well, Captain Picard is there. He doesn't quite think that Data has found the character. But Picard, of course, played by Patrick Stewart, a well-established Shakespearean actor, then has a little bit of an exchange with Data about the meaning of the Tempest. Let me quote. Data says, "Captain, I am not sure I fully understand this Prospero character. I would appreciate any insight you might have that would improve my performance." Picard replies, "Well, Data, Shakespeare was witnessing the end of the Renaissance and the birth of the modern era, and Prospero finds himself in a world where his powers are no longer needed. So we see him here about to perform one final creative act before giving up his art forever." Data replies, "There's certainly a tragic aspect to the character." "Yes," Picard says, "but there's a certain expectancy too, a hopefulness about the future. You see, Shakespeare enjoyed mixing opposites, the past and the future, hope and despair." Now, in that little passage, yeah, that's a very direct textual discussion of the significance of the Tempest. It has scholarly value in and of itself. But beyond that, happening as it does, right here at the very end, we have 3 episodes left of The Next Generation, this dialogue between Data and Picard is a discussion about the edge that the series is on, coming to an end. And it in Picard's lines, he is bringing up key themes that have always been present throughout Star Trek from the very beginning. This dialogue between hope and despair. Star Trek has always portrayed the future as being one of great tragedy, a nuclear war that devastates Earth, but also one of great hope. The idea that past that horrific loss of life, that devastation, there is a hopeful future, a positive future for humanity. This idea of a constant struggle between hope and despair parallels the constant struggle between emotion and logic that we see throughout the series. And the balance between those two that I would argue is the central thematic drive of the series. So I've made my case now about the importance textually of The Tempest in building what we could think of as the generic Star Trek episode. I've shown you how these characters map onto a template driven by the original script of the play. Although it's interesting to note that despite multiple interviews and discussions with the writers, they don't ever actually say any of this out loud. So I question to what extent they were conscious of it at first. Certainly, Gene Roddenberry is a writer who is responsible for writing and editing many of the early episodes, tended not to admit his influences, and tended to be a very subconscious-driven writer. He would just put out ideas on the page where he did not realize how much he was revealing about himself. But why should we care about this as people not just watching the show, but why is this important for me as a writer to look at this? Well, this gets into the origins of The Tempest itself. The Tempest, among Shakespeare's plays, is a weird one. It's hard to classify. It's not a tragedy, but it has elements of intrigue like Hamlet or Macbeth do. It's definitely not a history, since none of this really happened. While in a strict categorization, most scholars come down saying that The Tempest is a comedy. Why? Because people get married at the end and nobody dies. It also doesn't really center around the romantic couple the way that a Shakespeare comedy tends to. Instead, the origins of The Tempest seem most likely to be in the Italianate 15th century art form called the Commedia dell'arte. 16th century. The Commedia dell'arte is a form that evolves over a long period of time, but began to really codify itself during the 16th century as a genre of play that was not focused so much on plot, but on the interactions between stock characters. Strong personality types defined by a short list of traits, reacting to each other, bouncing off each other. A know-it-all doctor, an effete rich man, a bawdy clown, or jester figure. Now, this art form goes on to have influence all over Europe. If you look at Molière's plays, Molière is basically commedia dell'arte. You can see a lot of it in comic opera. If you look at The Marriage of Figaro, that's basically commedia dell'arte. And in The Tempest, you see expressions of a lot of commedia dell'arte archetypes. You have Ferdinand and Miranda as the love-struck couple. You have Trinculo the jester. You have a drunk, you have a doddering old man. Now, it is possible I'm overstating my case here because this form seems to be a natural origin for episodic television in general. You have an ensemble cast who are going to react to each other in a sitcom-like fashion. You don't need to reintroduce the characters each time. Instead, you're just going to pose certain challenges to them and see how the characters respond under those circumstances. But if you go a bit further back, where did Commedia dell'arte come from? I will also admit here, the available historical evidence starts to get patchy as we get before the Renaissance. The roots seem to be in medieval, what are classified nowadays as morality plays, where these archetypal characters have their origins in different expressions of particular virtues and vices. Think, if you're not familiar with it, think about the idea of, say, seven characters, each of which represents one of the seven deadly sins, although that's not exactly what was going on. So, I haven't really answered the question yet, why should we care about any of this? Another detour. Another template that recurs again and again in myth and literature is the hero's journey. This is the infamous one. You have a hero that has some sort of mysterious supernatural origin, or not necessarily supernatural, but mysterious, or he comes from a far distant land. He fights a big bad but fails. He goes out into the wilderness. He meets a companion who helps him build his powers. He returns and he triumphs over the big bad. So it's a very short summary. Joseph Campbell broke the hero's journey down into 17 distinct phases. But you know what hero's journey narratives are because you're familiar with Beowulf, or the Epic of Gilgamesh, or the story of Jesus, or Hamlet, or the Legend of King Arthur, all of which broadly follow hero's journey beats. In fact, you begin hearing references in the 20th century to the hero's journey as the monomyth. This is the assertion that the hero's journey is a universal template for stories. That there is something inherent and fundamental about the hero's journey, and that everything can be, I obviously don't agree with this perspective, but that everything can be read as the hero's journey. There are a couple of reasons this happened. Part of it is just simple self-reference. When the hero's journey began to be recognized as a phenomenon, it quickly became the basic story. If you were taking a creative writing class, the first thing that you would hear about in terms of a story template would be the hero's journey. I have a colleague at work. I'm a math teacher by day, as I said. One of my friends in the English department centers his entire year 9 curriculum around the hero's journey. And these are kids who are 12, 13 years old, and they're learning about this monomyth idea. So that's the innocent reason, is that the hero's journey is simple to recognize and teach. But another thing that's going on there that leads to the dominance of the hero's journey in contemporary literature is that as we get into the late 20th century, there's a very deliberate project in the United States to center hero's journey narratives. Why? Well, the hero's journey is a very patriarchal, very ruling class story. It centers destiny, it centers confrontation, it centers a division of the world into good and evil. The hero's ends justify the hero's means. Maybe the hero does some things that are unheroic, but he comes out triumphant at the end. And in the United States, scared of the influence of socialist ideas, this narrative began to be deliberately spread by writers in the United States. Look up the history of something called the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which has had a profound influence on how creative writing is taught in the United States and across the English-speaking world. And you will see a history of a very deliberate orientation toward heroic narratives. For our context, consider the influence of another Campbell, not Joseph, but John W., the hugely influential Golden Age sci-fi editor. Campbell, who Jeanette Eng memorably described as a fucking fascist, pushed hero's journey narratives in stories he accepted and edited. And that had a lasting impact on the science fiction genre. A lot of what we think of as Golden Age sci-fi, as well as today, the template of the superhero film or the action film, are locked into hero's journey beats. But The Tempest is not a hero's journey. And look at this. Yes, you can squint and close one eye and say, okay, Prospero being on the island, this is the hero in exile. Or you can say, well, Ferdinand has to do all this stuff to win Miranda. So Ferdinand is the hero and he's overcoming this adversity to get the girl. It doesn't really work though. You can see these pieces of it, but The Tempest as a whole is not about ultimate triumph over adversity. The characters in The Tempest obtain happiness through forgiveness, duty, and humility. Caliban learns the error of his ways and decides to be a good servant. Prospero releases Ariel and gives up his powers. The traitorous dukes give up their stations. Prospero does not enact vengeance on them, even though he has the opportunity to. He does not destroy them. And by extension, Star Trek, not just the original series or Next Generation, but the entire franchise, in this context, exists as this enormous 60-year counterexample to the supposed universality of the monomyth. Star Trek has been showing us how to tell stories that are not hero's journey in a sci-fi context. To return to this idea of self-awareness that began to emerge around season 5, one character in Star Trek who is ripe for hero's journey narratives is Worf. The Klingons are always written as these big, operatic, violent characters. But very close to the end of Deep Space Nine, 723, I think, tacking into the wind, Worf achieves a final victory over Gowron, closes a 9-year arc, an arc that began in early on in Star Trek The Next Generation, but he does not take over the Klingon Empire. He gives up his chance for ultimate triumph and hands it to someone else. And again, when Worf has these things that start out as hero's journey stories, rightful heir, birthright, listen to these episode titles, The Sword of Kalos, Worf goes on abortive hero's journeys. It's set up as a hero's journey story, but ultimately, the character always makes a moral decision to turn away from ultimate victory for the sake of being a good person or for the sake of a greater good. Because ultimately, The Tempest isn't a romance, a comedy, or a tragedy. Coming out of this Commedia dell'arte tradition, it is a morality play. The best outcomes come from learning virtue, tolerance, and coexistence. And that is the same morality play as Star Trek. It's not just structurally, but thematically. We talk about Star Trek versus Star Wars. Star Wars is an almost archetypal hero's journey story. But Star Trek is almost always about morality and making good choices and being better people, not but doing what is best for yourself, not about achieving complete annihilation of your enemies, but learning to live with your differences, celebrating the diversity of characters in your world, and making good decisions in a complicated world. Anyway, that's it for my presentation. We have a little time for discussion, I think. Would anyone like to lead off on that? So apparently I covered everything. Okay, I'll give you, yeah.
So, I have a question. So this was very interesting and I really like the concluding remarks at the end, very, very good. How do you feel about how it has become with Picard and Discovery?
Yeah, we're in, Yeah, this is a good question. How have things become with these, what are called New Trek series, with Picard in particular, because Picard is a hero-centered story? Well, we've only seen one season of Picard so far, so it's hard to say exactly where they're going with it. I don't think, though, that the way that Picard is written, at least season one was written, is setting Picard up as that kind of figure. I think instead it's trying to build another ensemble. It's centered around the character of Picard, but he does have a lot of supporting figures who are playing very important roles in the series. Seven of Nine made significant appearances. Some of Picard's former crew from the Stargazer are regular cast members. Captain Rios has a really interesting story of his own. So, and since the ultimate outcome of this first series of the card was a kind of coexistence, a very synthetic one. I think the main theme in Picard so far is this more dialogue-centered approach. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but it involves a very important synthesis between two opposing ideas. And that is a whole other talk that I'm going to give someday about the role of artificial intelligence in Star Trek. As for the other series, Discovery and Lower Decks and Strange New Worlds, which no one has seen yet, it isn't out yet. Discovery suffers from only having 10 episodes a season, so the ensemble is not getting explored particularly fully. But it is orienting much more toward being ensemble-driven than it was initially presented in season one. And Lower Decks is very much in the template of 1990s Star Trek. So I don't think that this Fuller era, or this New Trek era, represents a big deviation. I do think that the so-called Kelvin timeline films, the ones with Chris Pine as Captain Kirk, those are more hero's journey stories, especially the 2009 Star Trek. And I think actually that's a big reason why the 2009 Star Trek doesn't work as well as a film. is because it's taking these characters that we're familiar with, and part of the whole reason this works is because we have these stock characters where we know the personalities, and we're forcing them into a hero's journey template. And so you end up with a very Kirk-centered story. They're off on Delta Vega in the wilderness for a while. They confront the Narada, and they fail, and they come back and confront it again and succeed. But it isn't very satisfying. It doesn't do the ensemble very well. All right? Okay, I'll let you cogitate for a minute or two, but in the meantime, I do have some books I want to plug. This is a short story that I wrote, and I'm selling these for €3. This is the story that was cited last year when I won the Chrysalis Award for Best New Writer from Finland. But my first proper full-length book is out as well, Infinite Metropolis. You can get this for like €11 on Amazon, but I'm selling it for a bit cheaper, €10 autographed. If you're interested in either of those, please see me around the convention. I will be here until Saturday afternoon. All right, thanks very much.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafiti, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. L'autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta. Andiamo! Andiamo, sbrigatevi!
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.